What is dedication?
The thing that drives me every day as a dad is Dariano. We call him Day-Day for short. Every day he's hungry for something, whether it's attention, affection, knowledge. And there's this huge responsibility in making sure that when he's no longer under my wing, that he's a good person. I want him to be able to sit back one day and go, we worked together, we did a good job.
That's dedication. Find out more at fatherhood.gov. Brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the Ad Council.
You have 5 new messages.
Hey, Carl, it's Jen from Finance. Could you submit your expenses this week?
Hey, Carl, happy Friday. It's Jen, Finance. Just need those receipts today.
Me again, Carl. Really need those receipts, like last week. Please just tell me where they are. Are you by your desk right now?
Finance teams, you shouldn't be chasing down Carl or anyone else. With Ramp, expenses are sent with a text and reminders happen automatically. Switch your business to ramp.com today and love finance again.
You're watching a Highwire Media podcast.
Welcome to the True Crime Never Sleeps show. I'm your host, as always, Larry Lease. On this episode, we're actually going to talk about the survival of Lisa McVeigh. And before we dive in, let me know your thoughts on this case in the comments section below. And with that, let's dive into today's episode. Our episode begins in March of 1967, when a little girl named Lisa McVeigh is born. Now, Lisa, from an early age, was introduced into a hard life. Her mother actually struggled with drug and alcohol addiction, which made her unable to care for Lisa, along with Lisa's sister. Because of this, Lisa was in and out of foster homes growing up. And needless to say, I don't need to go into how hard foster homes can be. So as a teen, she was finally sent to live with her grandmother in Tampa, Florida. Tampa is a city on Tampa Bay, which is located in the west central portion of Florida, along Florida's Gulf Coast. It sits within Hillsborough County. Tampa's population at the peak of our case was 1.4 million, and it is actually the most populous county in Florida, outside of the various counties that make up Miami. So Lisa lived with her grandmother and her grandmother's boyfriend. This wasn't the great situation it seemed to be. It wasn't like she left foster care and finally found that loving home with stability and protection that every child needs. According to all sources, Lisa suffered ongoing sexual abuse at the hands of her grandmother's boyfriend for 3 to 4 years. Lisa tried to report the abuse not only to her grandmother, but also to her own mother. Except, it was no use. They just scolded her for not being grateful that someone had finally taken her in and gave her her own bedroom and a house. Because remember, she had been in the foster care system because no one wanted to take care of her. The abuse was ignored by everyone that teenager Lisa told. So in the words of Lisa, it was an extremely traumatic childhood, and it was even harder to know that her grandmother not only condoned, but approved of this abuse, sometimes even standing there and watching it happen. So on November 2nd, 1984, Lisa McVeigh went to work. At this point in her life, she was a teenager, and she had got a job and was working at Krispy Kreme. Now, I don't know if everyone knows if Krispy Kreme is universal or not, but I feel like it is now. But it's a donut shop, for those of you who don't know. Really good donut shop. While at work, Lisa decided that she was going to take her own life when she got home. The life that she had been given was unfair, and no one was helping her. It felt like no one cared, and because of this, she just wanted to stop feeling the pain. She was going to work her shift at Krispy Kreme and go home and end her life. So in the early morning hours of November 3rd, 1984, Lisa was riding her bike home at around 2 a.m. after finishing her shift at Krispy Kreme. She had already decided her fate. She had just worked a double shift, and according to some sources, she willingly stayed and worked double because she didn't want to go home to the house of horrors that she was currently living in and face the decisions she had made. So while she was riding home in the darkness, someone suddenly grabbed her off her bike from behind. Lisa started screaming. Her attacker put a gun to her head and said, "Shut up, or I'll blow your brains out." The man tied her up, blindfolded her, and threw her into his car. So not only is she getting abused, she's now, on the night she planned to end her life, just got grabbed off her bike by somebody. Somebody who has a gun. Once in the car, Lisa knew what happened next. And it did. She was sexually assaulted. But Lisa, like many of us listening, was a fan of true crime shows. Because of this, and I'm not sure how she had the strength, she began avidly taking note of her surroundings and the details around her. Through a small space below the blindfold, she noticed details of the car, and she eventually figured out it was a reddish-colored Dodge Magnum. After the attack, Lisa was hoping the man would let her go, but he climbed into the front seat and began driving off with her, still blindfolded in the back seat. She kept track of which direction they were driving and how long they were driving for. She even counted every step her attacker took as he pulled her out of the car and eventually carried her inside of a home. Thus began a terrorizing and dreadful hell that Lisa just couldn't seem to get away from. Lisa's attacker repeatedly assaulted her and beat her, all while threatening her with a gun. And it was while tied up and blindfolded in what she's assuming is his home that she heard a news report on the TV about herself being missing. This is actually very similar to the live show moment that podcast I listened to did, which also covered this episode, or this case. But it's also a little ironic to me that people who are abusing her care about her enough to report her missing. So at least Lisa figured, while listening to this news report of herself being missing, she figured, okay, that's it. I'm going to be murdered. I was abused. I was taken. I've been sexually assaulted. And now I know where this ends. And it was in that moment she realized just how much she wanted to live. She had left work that night with the intention of dying, but not like this. And now in the face of it, she did not want this. I think it's such a hard thing to go through, and it makes me sad. So with every hour that passed, the reality grew stronger for her. Lisa decided that if this was to be her fate, her murder would be solved. She did her best to leave behind as much forensic evidence as possible, so her attacker would be caught. She purposely touched surfaces, leaving behind as many fingerprints as she could in the house. And in between attacks, Lisa's attacker tried talking to her. And although she was so scared, she began inventing stories in hopes of trying to gain sympathy from her attacker. She talked about how she had this amazing father who had gotten sick, and she was the sole caregiver of him. And so she doesn't even mind that what's happening here, but she really does need to get home, or he would die. Like, he is no one except her. Now we know this is not the case. Lisa does not have a good home life, but she's trying to play on her attacker's emotions. So when her attacker opened up about, you know, why he's doing this, she's trying to sympathize with him. Why are you doing this? What's happened that makes you feel like you need to do this? He said he was trying to get back at women in general because of a bad breakup he had. And she lied to him and sympathized with this in order to appease him and calm him down and almost cuddle him. And after 26 hours of being kidnapped and this back and forth, sexual assaults in between, against all odds, Lisa's plan worked. She convinced him to load her back in the car blindfolded, that she wouldn't tell anyone, and he could just take her home. He first drove to an ATM and, by some accounts, stopped at a gas station as well. He then dropped her off behind a business around 4:30 a.m. blindfolded, and he instructed her to wait 5 minutes before taking the blindfold off so that he would have time to drive away. And when leaving, he said, "Tell your sick father he's the reason why I didn't kill you." This man got into his maroon car and drove away. Lisa ripped her blindfold off, and the first thing she saw was this amazing oak tree above her. She couldn't help but be overcome with thoughts about how she had wanted to die before all this, and now, looking at this tree, her attacker actually letting her go, she wanted more than anything to live. Life was worth living. She had found that. Lisa got up and ran all the way back to her grandmother's house. However, when she arrived, her grandmother and her grandmother's boyfriend, who was her abuser, didn't believe her story. In private, her grandma's boyfriend beat her for cheating on him. Well, they did report her missing, so once she was found, they had to say, "Oh, never mind, she's back." And law enforcement was already too involved in the case because, like I said, they had heard her story. And so when they hear the story about being kidnapped, despite the fact that her grandma doesn't believe her, the cops miraculously do. The Hillsborough County Sheriff's Office urged the Tampa Police Department to send Lisa's rape kit evidence to the FBI lab. They're like, "Okay, we found her, she's back, and we need to start investigating." Now, you might be wondering, if her own family weren't pushing police and Lisa had come home, why are the police involving the FBI like this? This is usually the opposite of what we see happening, especially in teenage missing person cases that return home in less than 48 hours. But that's because there was something else going on in Hillsborough County besides Lisa's abduction. Something big. In fact, police had clung to Lisa's story because they were hoping it was the lead that they had been needing in another case. Unbeknownst to Lisa or her family, Hillsborough County in 1984 had an active serial killer. A brutal one who since March, so 8 months earlier, had already abducted and murdered 9 girls. Police couldn't help but wonder, was Lisa the 10th victim that somehow this brutal and rampant serial killer had set free? They had to look into this. They were like, maybe Lisa's our lead. According to Murderpedia.org, Hillsborough County averaged around 30 to 35 homicides per year in the early 80s. And then, that all changed in 1984 when the murder rate in Tampa escalated dramatically due to a rapid-fire series of murders of young women. Law enforcement suspected there was a serial killer on the loose. The killer's MO was to bind, rape, and kill young female victims and dump them in secluded spots, displaying their bodies in unusual poses. 10 women had already been murdered in a relatively small area of Tampa during an 8-month period in 1984. Like I said, the women were all young, ranging in ages from their teens to the oldest at 28 years old, all relatively short, between 5'2 and 5'6, and most were taken from the same area around Nebraska Avenue in Tampa. The killer kidnapped and murdered each woman, dumping their bodies in deserted places. And like many serial killers, this one targeted women who were vulnerable. He was killing people who were vulnerable, including women who were walking or riding a bike alone, who were maybe sex workers or exotic dancers. He would either persuade or force them into his car, where he would then sexually assault, torture, and murder them. According to a November 1984 issue of the St. Petersburg Times, and like I said, the murdered women all disappeared from the same general area, which is how the serial killer was even suspected. The majority of these of their bodies were found along Nebraska Avenue, which housed a strip of nightclubs, kind of a more lively area that many of the victims actually worked at. In order of disappearance, here are the victims. Artis Anwick, Peggy Long, Michelle Sims, Elizabeth Ludenbeck, Vicki Elliott, Chanel Williams, Karen Dinfrind, Kimberly Hopps, Virginia Johnson, and Kim Marie Swan. Apologies if I butchered any of their names wrong. So right now we're going to list every victim and what happened to that specific victim. If you're watching YouTube, you will have a picture of them. The first was Artis Anwick, who was 20 years old at the time of her murder. She's now considered to be the first known murder victim. She was from a small town in Indiana, who then hitchhiked to Tampa to join her sister Becky, who was living there. At about 11 a.m. on March 27th, 1984, she left her apartment on East 10th Street to get a pack of cigarettes and never returned. She was reportedly a sex worker whose skeletal remains were found in rural southern Hillsborough County on November 22, 1984, approximately 8 months after she was murdered. A little over a month later, Peggy Long was 19 years old at the time of her murder. She was originally from Southern California. She went by Peggy or Alana Long and had been working in Tampa as an exotic dancer at the Starlight Lounge and Sly Fox Lounge. She had recently quit her job as a dancer to study art and cinema at the University of South Florida, which is crazy to hear because I went to that school. So it's just crazy that there was a serial killer victim tied to it. Her body was found on Mother's Day, May 13th, 1984, the same day she was murdered near an overpass on East Bay Road. Two boys who were playing in a field actually found her body. She was naked, her hands were bound behind her back, and her legs had been posed 5 feet apart, which is very disgraceful to do to a body. 2 weeks later, another young woman was murdered. So these are pretty back-to-back. This is a rampage. There's not like a couple of months in between them. Like, he's just finding and killing people. Michelle Sims was her name. She was 22 years old at the time of her death and was from San Bernardino County, California. She had been in beauty pageants and had worked as a receptionist at a Fort Pierce massage parlor. Now, Fort Pierce is about midway between Miami and Orlando on the east side of Florida. She then moved to Tampa in May of 1984, the very same month that she would be killed. Her body was found bound and stabbed on May 27th near an Interstate 4 overpass by Plant City. She was last seen at some bars on West Kennedy Boulevard. According to an opinion by the Florida Supreme Court, there were three possible causes of her death: strangulation, head injuries, or bleeding from two knife slashes to her neck. So this was definitely overkill. According to Google Maps, Kennedy Boulevard intersects with Nebraska Avenue, not far from where Interstate 4 and some other highways converge in Tampa. I say this so you can see that they're all kind of being found in a similar area. So back in June of 1984, Sheriff Walter Heinrich warned that a serial killer may be targeting young women in Tampa, Florida. This was after a couple of victims, and they were like, okay, we think there's something going on. Gary Terry, which I think is just kind of a funny name, of the Hillsborough County Sheriff's Office, became the lead investigator on the case. And according to his interview with WFLA.com, he said, quote, "The series of homicides started, and we were finding a body. It averaged out about every 2 weeks. He said it was a race against time. You know, if you don't solve it soon, someone else is going to die. Which, now you understand why when Lisa came forward and was like, I was just kidnapped and then he let me go, police were like, oh my gosh, this might be a huge lead. We have another survivor. Like, this can make the case. I don't know if you're a fan of Criminal Minds listening to this, but this is the most Criminal Minds like real life true crime case I've ever heard of. And you will see why even more towards the end. But still, even just this, like them having a race against time because the killer is just moving so fast, is so Criminal Minds-ish. So between March and November 1984, discovery of the bodies during an 8-month period was awful. It was awful for police. It was awful for everyone around. One crucial piece of evidence kept appearing in every crime scene. Dead nylon carpet fiber. Also, one of the tire tracks showed one tire that was particularly rare. So whatever car this killer was driving, one of the tires was different. However, law enforcement officers weren't able to track down the killer based on these clues. They were just going to help get conviction, basically. They didn't have enough information. Not until Lisa McVeigh survived and was possibly the 10th victim of the serial killer. Linda did survive, but it's important to note here that sometimes I feel like when we cover survivor cases or someone survived a case, it's so they're amazing. Every survivor has made it amazing. Body responses are different to trauma, so there's a high chance that Linda responded differently during the attack than Lisa did. And no one is right or wrong. I'm not putting one on a pedestal or one not. I'm just saying there's a chance that Lisa could provide more information than Linda could. You also have to remember, Linda had kids in her house, so her attention was probably not even on herself. It was most likely on her kids and protecting her kids. She probably wasn't even paying attention to the attacker very much, whereas Lisa was alone with him for a very long time, and so she might have even had more of a chance to pay attention to him as well. No source said, oh, this is why Linda didn't, you know, but I'm just assuming and being gentle to the fact that all survivors are different and traumatic responses are different and the situations were different. So after Lisa was released from her captor on November 4th, 1984, she told police everything she could remember because they were very interested in her case. According to WFLA.com, she saw the word Magnum on the dash of the car. White leather seats, a red carpet interior. Remember, there were red carpet fibers found on all the victims. She also saw and heard him stop at an ATM on the way to drop her off. She also was able to retrace their steps from the night she was abducted. She recalled that they had stopped at the ATM at about 3 a.m. and that they passed the Howard Johnson's motel as they drove on the interstate. All of this she was seeing while peeking out of her blindfold. On November 13th, the FBI lab called with huge news. The same red fibers found on Lisa's clothes had been found on the other homicide victims. Lisa was for sure, undoubtedly.
You have 5 new messages. Hey Carl, it's Jen from Finance. Could you submit your expenses this week? Hey Carl, happy Friday. It's Jen, Finance. Just need those receipts today. Me again, Carl. Really need those receipts, like last week. Please just tell me where they are. Are you by your desk right now?
Finance teams, you shouldn't be chasing down Carl or anyone else. With Ramp, expenses are sent with a text and reminders happen automatically. Switch your business to ramp.com today and love finance again. You've done it again, finance teams. You closed the books and it went fine. Sure, some expenses were missing receipts, but that's fine. Stayed late to process invoices by hand. It's all fine. But don't you deserve better than fine? With Ramp, expenses are submitted with a text, invoices are coded automatically, and everything is connected to your accounting system so you can close the books without all the busy work. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.
The 10th known victim of their serial killer. On November 14th, 1984, a special task force was formed by Tampa and Hillsborough County law enforcement to investigate the series of murders. The task force was comprised of the Hillsborough County Sheriff's Office, the Tampa Police Department, the Florida Department of Law Enforcement, and the FBI. Approximately 30 officers were assigned to the task force. After this, detectives matched local owners of a Dodge Magnum with a list of those who made an ATM transaction during the time that Lisa was held. So, like, we know you went to the ATM, so we can make a list of everyone who went to the ATM around this area. And then they also said, so we'll take owners of Dodge Magnums, and we'll take a list of people who went to the ATM around this area during the time she was held, and we'll see if any of the names match. And some of them did. There were more than one. So on November 15th, two detectives spotted a car and suspect matching the description they'd gotten from Lisa and from Linda's physical description. However, they didn't arrest the suspect immediately. Instead, they took photos of the suspect and the car, notified their superiors, and obtained an arrest warrant. The warrant was for 31-year-old Bobby Joe Long. His name was on a list police had made the day before. So they're like, okay, we have eyes on this guy. Matches the physical description. He has the car. Let's check him against the list. They got a warrant to search his apartment and his car. The arrest warrant was for charges pursuant to the Lisa McVeigh case. So they didn't pursue him for any of the other cases, just for Lisa. According to chillingcrimes.com, police kept Bobby under surveillance for 36 hours until they arrested him, maybe hoping that they would catch him in the act. Law enforcement then executed the search warrants, searching his apartment, car, and gathered forensic evidence, which would ultimately tie him to the cases. The carpet fibers found on the victims traced back to Bobby's car. They had found their killer. Now, I know you guys know this. I don't enjoy talking about the killers or the predators in our stories. I don't want to give them any more time than I have to. But I'll examine the psychology in their life, if it might have something to do with the case, which is why we'll even tap into Bobby Joe Long at this point. Bobby Joe Long was born on October 14th, 1953 in West Virginia. He was reportedly born with an extra X chromosome, a genetic condition called Klinefelter syndrome, which results in excess estrogen development and some female traits, such as breast development. So Long was bullied and teased mercilessly as a child due to his large breast. Because of this extra X chromosome, he underwent breast reduction surgery during his adolescence to try to combat this. Bobby's parents actually split up when he was a young boy, and he spent most of his childhood in Florida with his mother. His father was around, and he had a highly dysfunctional relationship with his mother. According to multiple sources, Bobby also sustained multiple head injuries due to various accidents while he was growing up. He had fallen out of a swing, fallen down a flight of stairs, been hit by a car, and been thrown from a horse. Most of these accidents had rendered him unconscious for a period of time. Bobby failed the first grade, and according to biography.com, he developed a hatred for a woman that began with his mother. He actually shared a bed with her in their one-bedroom apartment until he was about 12 or 13 years old, and she had a habit of bringing men home often, which experts say could have led to the resistance and hatred because he had to share the same bedroom as she was still actively having an adult life. Bobby married his high school sweetheart in 1974 and had two children. After this, Bobby was involved in a serious motorcycle accident, and his wife later claimed that his temperament changed following this, and he became very violent with her and the children. Bobby Long had also developed a strangely overt, compulsive, and often dangerous sex drive. Crime analysts would later attribute his violent character to a sexual obsession, labeling him as a sexual sadist. Again, if you watch Criminal Minds, you know why I'm drawing a connection to this case. Despite the violence, Bobby and his wife stayed married for 6 years, living in Long Beach, California. And this is where he began committing his first sexual assaults. His MO was to contact women who were advertising some household item for sale through the classified ads like the local Penny Saver. However, there isn't much details about these crimes, and all the reports say he was never prosecuted in California for these rapes. Now, if you remember Linda, this is the exact way she was attacked. And also, she was left alive, which he left every victim alive in California of the assaults as well. After the divorce, Bobby moved back to Florida to live with a female friend who would later accuse him of sexual assault and battery. Apparently, Bobby continued his behavior of raping women he found through classified newspaper ads in Florida. But I want to clarify that I looked and I can't find any real proof in terms of court records to back this up. It's just said that he did this, but either none of these women came forward or there's nothing in court details that I can find for this. According to at least one report, he would respond to ads selling things like small appliances. If he found a woman home alone, he'd then assault her. He'd accomplish this by asking to use the bathroom, taking out his rape kit. Now, I'm not sure what was in this, maybe something like to tie the victims up, to gag them, whatever, and then would assault and rob the women. According to multiple sources, Bobby committed at least 50 rapes in the Miami and Fort Lauderdale area using this method. And this is all before he begins attacking in Tampa. So he eventually became known to police in Miami and the Fort Lauderdale area as the classified ad rapist. And this is all before he goes on to kill. According to Investigation Discovery, Reddit.com, he was actually caught at one point in 1981 and went on trial for one of the assaults. He was convicted, but requested a new trial, and Bobby's request was granted. So apparently there might have just been some mistake somewhere along the way that granted him a new trial. But before the new trial could take place, the charges were dropped, and Bobby Long was once again out on the streets. So I do want to give a note to our listeners and viewers. Please be careful when letting strangers into your home, especially when no one else is with you. Don't trust them just because they claim to be interested in looking at the toaster you have for sale. Same goes if you're selling your car. Anything at all. Don't be home alone, don't let strangers in, and consider doing it in a public area like a grocery store or business of some kind. I think a lot of people are guilty of this. A lot of people have done it, like they let people in because they're coming to pick something up. And of course, they'd just be like, sure, come in. So this was even something that most people just need to get better at. I know the term, it's better to be safe than sorry, is overused, but it truly is. Don't be worried about looking stupid or feeling stupid. It is better safe than sorry, so we all need to get better at this. By 1984, Bobby was on probation for assault, but I can't find any further details as to what that specific attack was. He was also reportedly fired from his job as an x-ray technician at Tampa General Hospital and was living alone, obviously living in Tampa now. And of course, he was driving a 1978 maroon red Dodge Magnum. So just 12 days after Lisa was released, Bobby was captured on November 16, 1984, and transported to the Hillsborough County Sheriff's Office for questioning. Basically, because of the details that Lisa gave and they were able to make the list, that was really the only reason they found him. He was reportedly arrested outside of a Tampa movie theater. He was given his Miranda warnings and signed a formal Miranda waiver. He agreed to be questioned. During the ensuing 1.5 hours of questioning, Bobby Long confessed to the kidnapping and assault of Lisa McVeigh. Authorities then began asking him about the serial rapes and murders. Detectives left the room to grab the photographs of the various murder victims and then returned to the interrogation room and asked Bobby if he had ever picked up any sex workers in the area or ever came across women riding their bicycle alone. At this point in the interrogation, Bobby stated, quote, I'd rather not answer that. Detectives then confronted him with photographs of the murder victims. According to the Florida Supreme Court's opinion, Bobby said, quote, the complexion of things have sure changed since you came back in the room, and I think I might need an attorney. And those were his exact words. So he was totally fine admitting to Lisa, and that's all he thought police knew about. So he said, yep, I did it. Kidnapped her, assaulted her, but I let her go. I didn't murder her. Like, you know, I have a problem, but it's okay, I didn't kill her. Then they come back in, lay out all the pictures, and they say, also, we think you did the rest of these. All the other 11 of these. At the time, it wasn't 11 because they hadn't drawn all the conclusions, but we know it was 11. And he said, okay, yeah, you think I'm a serial killer? So I think I'm going to need an attorney now. Law enforcement didn't provide Bobby with an attorney, but continued the interrogation. Bobby ended up confessing to Virginia Johnson's murder and some of the other murders as well. The confession would serve as the basis for one of his later appeals. So he still does go to court, but it will serve as one of the basis for his later appeals, as Bobby argued that this was in violation of his Miranda rights. According to the Florida Supreme Court, because he obviously did it, and I mean, they haven't even gotten it, they want a confession though. It just sucks. So, according to the Florida Supreme Court, Bobby provided graphic details of his murders during his confessions, details that only the murderer would know. And I don't need to go into too many of these details, you know, more than I already have, but let's just know it's awful. Like when I said the detail about him displaying the bodies in weird ways, that's just covering the brim of what he did to these women. He talks about driving around with rope and weapons in his car looking for victims. So you know, he's just a horrific serial killer. Once he was arrested, police put Bobby or a photo of him in a lineup for Lisa McVeigh to see if she could identify him. Because she had felt her attacker's face and also caught small glimpses of him through the small gap beneath her blindfold. Lisa was able to identify him in the lineup. The gritty details of the trial and the sentencing phase of this case were a little confusing, but to my understanding, it's that on April 27, 1985, Bobby Joe Long was convicted of kidnapping and murder of Virginia Johnson in Pasco County, for which he was sentenced to death on May 10, 1985. Apparently, this is the one murder that happened outside of Hillsborough County, so it's a completely separate trial. He's convicted and sentenced to death for it. Then Bobby Joe Long ultimately reached a plea agreement with the Hillsborough County State Attorney's Office, where he agreed to plead guilty to 8 of the homicides and to the abduction and rape of Lisa McVeigh. Which, at this point, I mean, he's going to jail or getting the death penalty, right? But I will say, it does hurt for the living victims who, their daughter or friend or whoever's name is not on the list. I know that everyone else is like, well, but we know it was him. But it's still, you want the formal justice, you want the closure. So these charges included at least 8 counts of first-degree murder, 9 counts of kidnapping, 8 counts of sexual battery, and 1 probation violation. In exchange, the state agreed to not seek the death penalty, except for the crimes against Michelle Sims, as they were extremely, extremely brutal. Like I said, I'm not going to go into details on that one, but they were like, we can't give that up, we have to get the death penalty on that one. The judge, possibly a jury for sentencing and death penalty, sentenced Bobby to multiple life sentences and to death. Law enforcement believes that Bobby was responsible for many more rapes than he was charged with. As we talked about earlier, now you might be asking, well, if they were going for the death penalty anyways, why did they even take a plea deal? Like, why not just charge him? Because it's easier. Costs taxpayers less money. If he takes a plea deal, costs everyone less time, less effort. So if they were already going to get the outcome they wanted, they were totally okay with giving him a plea deal for some of them. Bobby Joe Long spent 34 years in prison until his execution, among the longest stints on death row of any Florida inmate. Governor Ron DeSantis signed Bobby's death warrant in April 2019, which is literally only 6 years ago. Like I said, he tried to appeal because of the whole Miranda rights thing, but that was just for a couple of the charges. They were like, yeah, we have you on the other charges that didn't happen during that confession, so we're going to let it stand. He was executed by lethal injection on May 23rd, 2019. Lisa McVeigh sat in the front row wearing a shirt that read, Long Overdue, because his last name is Long, which I think is kind of funny. Lisa McVeigh said, quote, I wanted to be the first person he saw. Unfortunately, he didn't open his eyes the whole time. Survivor Linda was also present to witness Bobby's execution. According to the Gainesville Sun, she said it was hard to be in the same room as her attacker, but noted that justice had finally been served. Family members of other victims were present as well. Bobby Joe Long died without saying a word. He was pronounced dead at 6:55 p.m. inside the death chamber at Florida State Prison. Lisa McVeigh actually left her abusive home after the attack and moved into a runaway center, according to various reports, in a Lifetime film based on this whole story. Police not only believed Lisa about Bobby, but they also 100% believed her about the abuse that was going on in her home life. The grandmother's boyfriend was then arrested. I haven't been able to find any more information as to what became of grandma and boyfriend. The identity of McVeigh's grandmother and her boyfriend are actually unknown. It's kind of frustrating to me that they are, because they were a huge part of Lisa's story. But I mean, whatever, maybe she wants it to be that way, I don't know. She later moved in with an aunt and uncle, Aunt Carol and Uncle Charlie, who were loving and treated her well after everything. Definitely better than she'd been treated by any family before this. In 2004, Lisa McVeigh, who now goes by Lisa Nolan, signed up for the police academy and pursued a career in law enforcement. She eventually became a Hillsborough Sheriff's Deputy, working for the same department that had investigated her case, and not only arrested her attacker, but also saved her from the family life that she was in. She still works there to this day. Lisa Nolan specializes in sex crimes and has been working to protect children for almost 2 decades. She also works as a school resource deputy and motivational speaker. Lisa got married to a police officer 2 years after her abduction, and the couple had a daughter before their 5-year marriage ended. She states that surviving the trauma and abuse during her childhood is what gave her the ability to take notes and stay calm while being attacked by Bobby. Which goes back to what we were talking about before. She had been through crap, she'd been through hell. I'm not saying she was used to it, but she definitely had found coping mechanisms before this. We tell this story in honor of Lisa, her life and her legacy, but also in honor of every victim taken at the hands of evil. Sometimes in these serial killer cases, the victims can become just a number or a number on the page because there are so many of them. So I want everyone who's watching or listening to take the time today to think about each and every one of them. Honor and remember them. And this was the survival story of Lisa McVeigh, Linda Nuttall, and the victims of Bobby Joe Long. It's crazy because we don't know. We haven't done many serial killers on this show. And it's, I mean, obviously all murder, all killing, sexual assault, anything in that matter is evil and horrible. But something about a serial killer, someone who just, especially Bobby Joe Long, he just killed, killed, and killed, like month after month after month. Who knows how many people he killed in different states that we don't, I mean, we don't know, you just never know. Sexually assaulted, that's huge. It's disgusting, it's disturbing. Bobby Joe Long is disturbing. But yeah, you know, you say we haven't covered a lot of serial killers, and that's because sometimes I feel like serial killers just live in infamy. Which they do because they're interesting, and you're like, why do people do this? And you want to know every detail, and you're fascinated. And there's nothing wrong with that. But times, like I said, the victims of these infamous serial killers can be overshadowed by the killer themselves or their self. So that's why I really want to, if we ever do cover a serial killer, I want it to be victim heavy. I want it to be victim focused. I still want to acknowledge the fascination of a serial killer, and I don't think there's anything wrong with that, but I also want to make sure we say their names and remember them and understand that they're not just another name on the page, which I think we've done. And with that, we'd like to thank our sponsor, NordVPN.
You have 5 new messages. Hey Carl, it's Jen from Finance. Could you submit your expenses this week? Hey Carl, happy Friday. It's Jen, Finance. Just need those receipts today. Me again, Carl. Really need those receipts, like last week. Please just tell me where they are. Are you by your desk right now?
Finance teams, you shouldn't be chasing down Carl or anyone else. With Ramp, expenses are sent with a text and reminders happen automatically. Switch your business to ramp.com today and love finance again. Sally from Finance loves fly fishing. She used to spend her weekend surrounded by receipts. Then she switched her company to Ramp. Now, spend is all under control, all in one place. Her team submits their expenses with a text, and she can close the books without all the busy work. So Sally's weekends are all her own, surrounded by fish, not receipts. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.